Hey everybody, welcome back to Dental Unfiltered. I'm Matthew Brown, and I'm here with my normal co-host, Andrew Vallow. And today we have Dr. Addison Killeen on the podcast. Addison's pretty unique. He's a DSI black belt coach, and also he has owned 6 practices, and he's also built 1 mega practice. And I'm really excited to see the contrast in his decisions. And first, you know, I want to start with you, Dr. Addison. What was the first deciding factor for you to want to make the transition from 6 to 1?
Yeah. So, and you know, Andrew and I have been in DSI for a while. We've kind of had some of these discussions before. And basically when you get to be, as you're growing a group practice, you know, it's blood, sweat, and tears. And so my story of 6 practices that started, you know, just like anybody has 1 really successful practice. The guy 100 feet away from us called us up one day and said, "Hey, I'm going to sell. I'm selling to you guys. Buy my practice." So we went to 2, and then quickly we went 3, 4, or 5, and then we did a 6th as a startup. And the startup did really great as well, but we did it mostly through acquisition. But through that model, you know, when you're growing like that, we did pretty darn good analysis of all these practices. They were profitable. They were good, but what happened is that it just takes so much management time and energy, and you're building up the infrastructure to be a DSO, and it just takes a lot of time and effort and, you know, work. You do have to sacrifice some profitability to get to that stage. I think after 6 practices, it starts to get easy. We had a pretty good management team built out by the time we got 3, because we had 3 relatively larger practices. We had like 8 ops, 12 ops, and 7 ops, maybe. And so we had some pretty good revenues out of those 3. The other 3 were kind of smaller. And so we had a good management team. We had a practice administrator, a CFO who did all of our accounts payable, bookkeeping, all that stuff. We had a marketing director. And then we had, you know, 6 good managers. But still, as the owner of that, it still just took so much time. And really, for me, the deciding factor was my kids were tiny. And it was basically meaning I was working kind of like Andrew. I was working 7 days a week. Every minute of every day was pretty much focused on work and managing and hiring. And we were getting to a pretty large team. And so it was just stealing too much time for me personally. And so I just said, you know what, like, I want to break this and start all over again. And so I sold out, basically took a year off, or actually even only maybe 6-8 months off, something like that. Yes, got out of it. Yeah, it was good for me to take a little bit of a break. I did not do dentistry for those 8 months, and I wasn't even really planning on getting back into it so quickly. But then, you know, there was a guy in town who got sick, and basically his practice went up for fire sale. Like, it was basically, we are closing the practice. You know, they didn't even call me. It was basically, I was talking to some of the other dentists in town, and they said, "Well, do you know what happened to Roger? He got sick, and like, they couldn't find a buyer for his practice. So they're just closing it up. Like, they don't know what to do with the charts." And so I was like, "Oh," so I called up the daughter, and I said, "You know, what's going on here?" And she's like, "Well, you know, my dad, he was a little older. He had recently redone all the equipment in the practice." And she said, basically, this is what the note is on the practice. Just pay the note, pay the debt off on the equipment, and you just take everything. Wow. And so I was like, "Well, all right." So I bought those assets and the charts, and a couple team members, basically. And, but I was already kind of thinking in my head, like, I wanted to do a startup anyway. So basically I ran that practice for a few months and then was building out the startup. And the startup is in a strip mall next to a CVS, where we started with 6 operatories. But pretty quickly, within about 2 years, we filled up, and that was August of 2019. And so then I went to the landlord that owns my strip mall, and I just said, "Hey, dude, you either got to sell me the strip mall, or I'm going to take off and go build my own building or something." And thankfully, like, he's a childhood friend and stuff. And so I told him, I was like, "You know, for how much construction costs go into the build out, everything, it's cheaper for me to stay. And so here's the numbers. Like, shoot me a number of what you want to sell me the building at. You can even tell your bosses at the insurance company that owns it, you know, basically tell your bosses that you can rip off the dentist and you make yourself look good. And I come out winning too. So we bought the strip mall. It had five bays in it. And we built out the second bay last summer. And then we are building out the third and fourth bay for our surgery center. We'll be done in about 3 months. So, and that'll take us from six ops where we were up to 14 ops. And so, yeah, so that's kind of the physical aspects of it. Yeah, we started with myself as like a part-time doctor. And then I have one partner in the practice who he works 4 to 4.5 days a week. And then we also have now in the last year, we've added two more associates. And now these associates each work 4 days a week. And so now we have four docs and most likely going to need five here this next summer as we finish construction. So the biggest reason, though, that I wanted to get out of the multiple practice game was just kind of the inefficiencies of having to manage multiple people in multiple locations and kind of having different cultures in each practice. It's super easy when you're the, and you know, you guys know when you're physically at a place every day, your culture, your ethos kind of just rubs off on everybody. And so it's just easy. Like it's managing one huge office is so, so much easier. And the revenues are still quite good. It's just an easier lifestyle for sure. So that was kind of the story of how I got from one to six back to one.
Being a new practice owner, I agree with what you're saying. Like your ethos or like, you know, leadership is the transfer of emotion, right? So when you're there every day, you walk in, you bring a certain energy, you get to direct the team where they should be. And it's just, it brings a different element, right? And when you're trying to remote manage that, that element, that human element, that human impact, that energy vanishes. Do you find that just aside from the financials and the numbers, when you walk into practice number four and it's just not what you wanted it to be, and they're not exactly saying what you want them to say during handoffs and stuff, it just gets under your skin a little bit and it personally bothers you on a personal level, not just the, like, let's say the practice is doing $300,000 or $400,000 a month. It's a super practice, but you go in and just the culture isn't what you want for your patients or you want the experience to be in your brand in that building. Does that, like, do you find that was part of what bothered you?
Well, and they see you differently, I think. When you walk in and you only show up once a week or once every other week, and then you're, like, trying to coach them, and it comes from a place of, like, I want you to get better, and I want you to be, you know, the best you can be, they don't see it that way because they just see you as the bearer of bad news. And that's always a tough thing to overcome. And, you know, you try to balance that with relationships and relationship building and leadership. There's a different culture. Yeah. When you're the owner, I mean, just by, I don't know, just the status of the tag of owner and like primary founder or whatever, it just carries a certain weight and they treat you differently. Even if you're nice as heck and you don't have to give that coaching, even if it's you have someone else that can do that for you, they just treat you differently. And often they like walk on eggshells around you. Whereas for me in this practice now, I love it. Like we're in the trenches together every day. And so, yeah, it is just a little bit easier when you kind of have those daily, you know, coffee machine interactions where you're just like chit chatting and shooting the bull, I guess.
So you like being that frontline leader a lot.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, for me, I built the practice 2 miles from my house, so I can drive here in 5 minutes. I can bike here in about 15 minutes. So usually most days I just bike to work because it's 15 minutes of meditation that I get. And it's on a trail with no cars or anything. So it's the absolute perfect practice for me. Although, you know, it's some people wouldn't be a good fit for, you know, a larger practice. And I don't consider myself, this isn't a mega practice. I think, you know, we probably know people around the country that have those 30 operatory practices that are, you know, gigantic. That's what I would consider mega. But this, it's good. I don't think after 14 operatories, I don't know. We might add a couple more in a few years, but I think 4 to 5 doctors is about perfect for culture and for the ease of management and to not be seen as too big. I think if you get a little too big, like 30 operatories, you might be seen as too corporate style. But who knows, maybe it's, you know, you add in some specialty procedures, or maybe you add in some pedo or ortho or something like that in the future, just to kind of improve care. But like, for me, I think this is about the right idea. And I think in terms of preoperatory revenue, you know, obviously I've written a few books and I do love digging into the numbers, but like the numbers of revenue per operatory in general for me are about 350 to 400,000 per operatory.
Is that per year?
So I think once we get to about
per year, per month, per year.
Per year. Yeah. So 350 times 14 will be about, you know, 4.9 million. Yeah. That's actually kind of low. You know, my goal this year, once we will have a few extra operatories in the summer, but our goal this year is 5.1 million. But realistically though, I bet we'll probably top out at about 7 to 8 million in the next few years. And that'll be just fine.
How many days a week are you at the office, and are they all patient like clinical days, or do you have admin days at the office?
Yeah, right now I'm 3 clinical days, but I'm usually at the office 4 days a week. So, so 1 management day. And so sometimes those management days are come in for a few hours and then I go home and work in the quiet of my own home or coffee shop or something. But yeah, 3 clinical right now. I like, you know, I think that's a really good balance from a health standpoint of my own back and neck issues, but I might cut that down to 2 in the future. Just, I only work actually all of us doctors only work 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. and then hygiene runs 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. with an hour lunch, but doctors don't take lunch. So
yeah, we don't do lunches at my practice at all. Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. people eat lunch. We just don't block off like an hour or anything.
I was at Andrew's practice. I was used to practice shutting down for an hour, which I also don't agree with. And they had this great, great lunch spread. I normally buy the practice lunch when I'm there. And all day long, I was waiting for everyone to start eating lunch, not knowing this. And it was like 3 p.m. I was like, so when do we get to eat? Because I'm pretty hungry. And I was like running around watching Andrew and stuff. And it was like, oh no, everyone's been picking throughout the day. You should have eaten. And I was like, I didn't know. I was scared.
We graze in my practice.
Yeah, they do. They definitely graze.
That's like, yeah, shutting down for an hour. There's so much efficiency in that. Now the hygienists they're great. Like they manage their own schedule. If they want to take a half hour lunch, they can schedule their patients however they want. Some days they take lunch at 11, some days at 1 p.m., you know, but for them, and I think for most patients, I think the working till 5 is pretty normal. For the doctors, I mean, our schedule ends at 4, but realistically we're, you know, finishing up stuff, writing chart notes, you know, wrapping up other stuff, doing hygiene checks until 5. But yeah, we found that to be pretty efficient. It's good for lifestyle because then like literally everyone is walking out the door at like 5:05.
Which is nice. Yeah. Yeah. We have some later evenings, but so the fourth day that you're at the office, do you feel like you actually get things done, or is it more just for interacting with the team, maybe meeting with office managers, things like that? Because like personally, I've found if I'm at the office, like I can't get any actual work done. So if I'm not seeing patients, I'm typically not there. Maybe I'll stop by to have a quick meeting with somebody. But usually if I'm doing my CEO work, I need to be at my home office or somewhere else doing that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's 50-50. I think some of the things, and I, you know, Andrew and you and I kind of run our probably a CEO checklist of like, what do I got to do every month? Sometimes it's financial. Sometimes it's you focus on marketing. Sometimes it's you focus on HR and hiring and onboarding. And yeah, it's really only the HR tasks that I like to be in the office for. Although I always do love coming in for morning huddles. Like I try to keep my morning routine pretty normal every day, every Monday through Friday, at least. And so I'll come in for morning huddle, get the team going. If I need to do any HR tasks, I'll get those done. But then I pretty quickly either lock myself in the office, and they know that like if the glass door is shut, you know, don't come knocking, or I'll try to get away and either work from home or go to Starbucks or something. Because yeah, inevitably, and I think you and I both know this, you get pulled into a hygiene check or, hey doc, this associate's running behind. Can you start anesthetic or can you do this extraction? And it's like, that just destroys your productivity.
I need to be able to like focus. It's very tough for me to work and like multitask when I've got different people asking me questions. So I realized that a long time ago, and I talked to some doctors who tell me they don't have any admin days outside of their practice. And I feel like that can be a challenge. As a business owner, you do need dedicated time to actually work on your business where you're not being distracted by your team members and things like that.
Oh yeah. 100%.
So I have a question for both you guys. So, you know, a lot of our dentists that are listening aren't in DSI, and they, I think dentists generally have a personal time management problem with where to apply their effective energy. Like they have you have so much energy to work, right? And then it hits a zero, and if you try to keep working, your productivity just falls off. And I'm a giant fan of DSI. I'm not a dentist, obviously, but I've interviewed Mark, and I love DSI, and I fell in love with it with the belt rank system because I'm a BJJ black belt. I thought that was so cool to me. So for both you guys, you know, what I know you'd mentioned like the glass door being shut and your staff knows not to come bother you. What mechanisms have you found to protect that amount of effective energy you need left for those admin days? And how do you really manage that? Like what tools do you actually put in place to say, this is when that time happens and that energy is available, and how do I protect
it? Yeah, I mean, I guess for the most part, it's just expectations and saying no. I think that's the saying no is the biggest thing, because if you start to let them creep in and steal your CEO time or your management time, they will, like, absolutely. And it's also fighting your own internal, I don't know, your internal scorecard of like, I'm a helper. You know, you say as a, like any dentist listening to this, we got into dentistry to help people, to care for people and to solve their problems. Well, your team members, you know, on the management side, they come to you with problems like, hey, this insurance company is giving me heck, or hey, this patient had this problem, or there's this billing problem, or, you know, this Invisalign ClinCheck needs to be done. They come to you with these problems, and you have to be very just clear with what your limitations are and say, hey, I solve those problems during different parts of the week. Like, I don't solve those today. So saying no, I think, is the biggest thing. And once, and it kind of sucks sometimes, at least personally, I feel like, well, dude, I could totally do that. That takes 15 minutes. I could seat that crown. I could pull that tooth, whatever. But saying no is probably the most important thing you can do for your own sanity, as well as, you know, just setting boundaries about what your time is, which I think is kind of why Andrew and I probably agree that working from home or working from somewhere else physically separated is just so important.
I need like these uninterrupted blocks of time. So what I try to do is I try to schedule any meetings I need to have, you know, even if they're like Zoom meetings at home, I try to schedule them in clusters. So it's like, okay, like today we've got this podcast recording, and then soon after that, I've got a meeting with the attorneys about something. And then soon after that, I've got a meeting with CPAs about something. But it's like, I'm just kind of knocking out all the meetings in a short block of time. And then I've got the rest of the afternoon free to work on things I actually need to do. And then tomorrow, Friday, I usually try to leave my schedule pretty light. And as of now, I don't think I have any meetings scheduled. So I basically have an uninterrupted admin day where I can just sit down and knock out a whole bunch of stuff. I agree with what Addison said. I think you have to say no, and not just to like your team, but to, I mean, we get so many people reaching out like, hey, doc, I want you to watch this demo. I think this can help your practice, or blah, blah, blah. I've done a lot of research to figure out the things that I want in my practice. So I don't just take demos, or I don't just take calls or meetings with random people. And my team knows that, you know, they're gatekeepers for me. People will call and they'll even try to pull a fast one. Oh, Dr. Vallo had requested more information about this. And they're like, no, he didn't. So I think being able to say no to people is huge. And then if there is something that I want to check out or something I think we may want to implement, I typically will try to delegate that, you know, initial meeting to one of my office managers, you know, one of our lead positions, let them take the call, let them do the demo, let them come back to me with their feedback. So before I invest, you know, any of my energy into that, I at least have some feedback from a team member first. We do the same thing now with hiring. So I used to do the initial interviews for all employees at the practice. And then if I thought they could be a good fit, I would invite them in for kind of like a working interview, meet the team, you know, maybe an interview with the office manager at the office. We flip the script. So now if I think someone might be a good fit based on their, you know, Indeed resume, either myself or our office manager will invite them to come to the practice. They'll meet with the office manager. They'll meet some of the team members. They'll kind of get a feel for our practice. And then if my office manager thinks they may be a good fit for me, then I'll sit down and have a Zoom interview with them to decide if I think they actually would be a good fit for the practice. And I may pop in and just introduce myself and say hello while they're at the practice, but I'm not investing significant amount of time because you only have so much time. So you need to be able to delegate things as much as possible and reserve the time that you do have for the, you know, the most important tasks. So
you kind of bring up one thing too, you know, your daily schedule, you like to do maybe meetings in the morning, deep work block time in the afternoon. There's an author, Carrie Newhoff, N-I-E-U-W-O-F, W-O-H-O-F. But basically, Carrie, he wrote the book called At Your Best. And so I'm a huge believer. You have hours of the day when you are physically and mentally at your best to both do those deep work blocks. And then you have some that are like medium importance, like you can get good work done, but it's not the best. And then you have those trash times of the day when you're just tired and, you know, you can't focus on anything. It's hard to, you know, do much more than watch Netflix. And so, you know, for me, the best times of the day are between 4:30 a.m. and probably 7 a.m., you know, early in the day. And so sometimes I'll just do deep work. Like that's when I write my books. That's when I, if I need to look over financial reports, stuff like that, because my kids aren't up, nobody's up, nobody's sending me emails, text messages, anything. And so I can totally focus on really deep work stuff. Then the first hour of the day in the practice after our, you know, 7:45 morning huddle, like the first hour or two, then I'm still pretty good. But by the time 2 or 3 PM rolls around, I'm trash. So I make sure to not leave any important things or try to do deep work blocks in the afternoon because I'm just not worthwhile. However, if I needed to just do some like bonding with the team or just like, hey, let's solve some problems in a team meeting or something, I could still do that because it's more me auditing their decisions, not necessarily having to like create my own ideas or do deep work issues like that. So I don't know, that would be some strategy for some dentists, like figure out when you have the most energy and that's when you should be attacking those big problems or setting aside that really valuable time.
I think that's a great point. And I'll tell you what, it kind of varies for me day to day. Like days that I'm clinical seeing patients, by the time I finish that day, I'm like all of my mental energy has been expended. So like if I sit down and try to do some Invisalign ClinChecs, which normally, I mean, are just mental, you know, it's so easy for me. It's muscle memory. I've done so many of them, but it can be a struggle because I'm just, my brain is so taxed at that point in time. Whereas days where I'm not seeing patients all day and not having all of these interactions with patients and team members, even if I've been working most of the day, I typically get like a second wind in the evenings and I'm able to get more stuff done. So like days I see patients, I don't plan to do anything at the end of the day. Whereas other days I'm often spending, you know, some time in the evening still getting work done.
I have a question, Addison. So you own 6 practices and, you know, docs, ultimately everyone, you're in dental to help people. You know, our job is to be compassionate caregivers for others is what you guys do, right? Which is awesome. But ultimately you guys have a lot of student loans. Your education is really expensive. Practice is really expensive. Money is part of it, right? So from a financial point of view of personal financial gain, was the 6 practices better financial gain to the effort you were putting out, or is a single practice?
Okay, so there's 2 kind of sides to that question. Okay. So there's the per year income that, you know, you get out of the 6 practices versus the sellout price. When we were building the DSO, it was not super profitable. We were reinvesting a lot of money. The sellout price was decent and it was good, but it was 2018, like a little bit prior to some of the hotter money. So like I made out okay. If we were to sell today, it would be a lot different, potentially higher, but then again, you never know. Whereas like right now, the profitability on one practice is ridiculous. So, you know, in the DSI belt system, you know, a white belt is someone at about 60% overhead. And so you could kind of run the math like, okay, you pay your doctors 30%, you have a 60% overhead. So you're only making 10% profit margin. So white belts are 10% profit margin. Brown belts are 15. So that's a 55% overhead. Black belts are 50% overhead. So black belts make 20% profit margin on the practice. And then we have like a new double black belt level, which is 45% overhead. And so 45% means you're taking home 25% of the revenues of the practice as profitability for the practice. It's really hard to be a black belt practice when you have 6 practices. You know, it's just, you could, like we ran pretty efficiently, but we were still at like 53% overhead. And we got up to about $7.5 million in revenue. So it was good, but it also like took a lot of time, took a lot of energy for that. Now on the flip side, you know, now I work 4 days a week. I leave the house at, you know, 7:20 in the morning. I get home. You know, yesterday I was home playing at the park by 4:45, you know, biked both ways. So I got an outside workout in, and this year we'll be at 5.1 million at about a 45% overhead. So it's pretty, I think it's much better in one practice to be at that level. Now I'm not looking to sell out though. So that equity, you know, cash out point, that's not really in my future, at least not in the near future. Who knows, maybe 15, 20 years from now. But at that point, the equity piece should probably have no large bearing on the trajectory of my retirement goals. So for me, you know, just let's say we get to 7 million at a 25% profit margin, you know, that'll be just fine. I think personally, I think it's much better.
When you sold your original group, did you sell to a DSO, and what kind of non-compete did you have? Because it sounds like you got another practice pretty quickly there.
Yeah, I was actually wondering about the same thing.
Yeah, so I sold to my partners. So they were minor partners and basically selling to them. So I didn't get as crazy of a number, which was okay. I had a year non-compete with, I couldn't take any of my existing older patients, which really didn't bother me too much anyway. You know, so they couldn't, my existing older patients couldn't come back to me for 12 months, and which, you know, didn't really have any impact since I was buying this other patient base anyway for, yeah. And so I think also there's the picture of debt, which kind of plays into the cash flow picture a little bit. When you do one practice, it's just so much less debt, in my opinion, than trying to do six different practices. Because six different practices, you're going to have six different rent or lease payments or mortgages, six different kind of, I don't know, beasts to manage on the debt side of the picture. And so having one practice, I have a couple, you know, each addition, each construction project we've done has added a little bit of debt, but then we just are pretty much cash flowing it now. So it's kind of, we take out a little bit of debt, we pay it off a month or two later. And so the debt picture in my current situation is significantly less than when I had six practices.
That's what contributes to your 45% being better. There's no debt service.
I mean, we've been pretty aggressive on paying down debt, and that's just a personal philosophy. I know some people leverage debt really well, but just the security aspect of just being able to get a good night's sleep, I just don't like to carry much debt. So, and that's aside, I didn't roll forward any of my previous liquidation assets or anything. Like I've made this, and partially because I just wanted it to be an experiment on when you do like a startup in construction the right way with the right systems, you know, I wanted to play the game as if I had to borrow all the money right up front to buy the assets of the practice, to do the construction and everything else. Like I played it as if I was still that 25-year-old coming out of dental school.
Yeah, I'm a big believer of cash is king. So like debt and leveraging debt doesn't really bother me. You know, I probably have lost some stomach lining over the last couple of years, but at the same time, I kind of see it as a necessary evil. We're typically not rolling assets from the existing practices into new practice build outs or anything, or at least we're trying to avoid that. So we're trying to keep getting the new projects fully funded. And Huntington's been a pretty good partner for us there. But when you had your group of six practices, did you have like a regional man, like a strong C-suite type of executive level manager to help out, or?
Yeah, we had the practice administrator. We had two different ones. Yeah, good leadership, good relationship abilities. I mean, that was kind of the biggest thing. And really they oversaw the six office managers. And I'd say in the six practices, you know, you had your A players and your B players. And so the A players got placed into the bigger practices. The B players were the smaller ones. And so kind of there was some natural coaching between the top levels and the bottom ones. We did kind of shift around a little bit. There was enough geographic spread that it wasn't like you could immediately, like if you asked someone to go from practice A to B, they'd be like, well, no, that's way across town. Like, I don't want to work there. That's a 25-minute drive. So there'd be some times where it was like, okay, you get to graduate up and take over a bigger practice. But I did have a pretty darn good C-suite. I'd say they were a B plus in terms of, well, the couple people that I had. They didn't come from the DSO world. One came from like the large hospital world. One came from the consulting world. So it was good though to at least have people that could, for the most part, you know, and those were, gosh, $60,000 to $70,000 employees. Like, wasn't crazy. But they saved a lot of stomach lining, as you say, you know, to be able to pass off quite a few of the problems.
I feel like that's the only way that I can make this growth kind of a long-term thing is if I really start getting some just really, really great leader C-suite type of employees in there. Because right now with the four practices, we just have office managers. And I mean, they're doing a good job, but there's still so much of then that direct reporting that comes back to me. And I'm already seeing, so our newest startups just opened, this will be their third week. This week is their third week, I guess. So this is newer to having the four practices, and I can already see just how exponentially more stuff there is to deal with, even with strong leaders at each practice here. So that's kind of where my mind is already at is, you know, if we're going to expand beyond these four, which right now is the plan, I need to start probably looking for some type of regional manager, operations manager, you know, it's some type of executive position there. So
yeah, and at four, once you get, it's still in the newbie stage, so it'll take a month before it kind of gets up to profitability. I mean, you're really good at operations, so it'll pick up. But then once you have about four, I think that's when you can really afford to pay for some really good C-suite people. It's tough because there's dentists out there that have bought their second or that have bought their third, and they're wondering, when is this all going to pay off? Because it feels like I'm working three times as hard,
yep,
and not seeing any more, or maybe a little bit more of a paycheck, but the headaches are three times bigger. I think at a certain point, you do start to hit those efficiencies of scale where you can afford to pay really good people. You know, like I, at the DSO, you know, when we had six, I never wrote a check. You know, I didn't do payroll. I didn't have to do any of those things because we always had really good people to kind of manage all those issues. And so I think that's something that when you're at two practices, you still can't quite hit that, or even three. But I think at four, yeah, you should be able to afford that. And then, you know, it always starts off as you can hand them a lot of small problems to just get their training wheels, you know, moving. And then as you break those off, you let them take bigger and bigger problems until you kind of should hopefully work yourself out of a bunch of those painful decisions.
Yeah, no, for sure. The nice thing is, you know, I think after having done a couple startups already, continuing down that same path is that I've gotten to apply a lot of what I've learned along the way to these new practices, and I've got to avoid a lot of the mistakes I made with the first two practices as well. So that's really set these new ones up for success. You know, the implant startup, they're on pace to collect about $150,000 our first month open. So that's huge. Like right off the bat, that allows us, you know, the opportunity to say, hey, like, do we want to add our fourth day? Do we want to add another employee there? That type of a thing. The general practice is a little harder because, you know, we're so insurance driven that we haven't got any insurance checks yet. So they've gotten off to a pretty good start as well. I mean, they're going to see well over 100 patients our first month open. Probably they'll probably produce about 75-80K, I'm guessing, this first month, but we'll see what happens. But either way, I mean, collections is very minimal because most of it's been insurance that we're waiting on. So you have to wait for that to catch up. And I think that's what a lot of docs don't realize when they're first doing a startup is like, hey, I mean, even if you market well and you get patients in the door right away, you still have to wait for insurance checks to come in. And you got to make sure you're doing it right. I mean, if you don't know what you're doing and claims aren't being sent out properly, it might not be 30 days, it might be 60 days, 90 days, all of a sudden, you know, you find yourself in a hole. So I think that's some really, really important advice. I don't know if we've talked about much on this podcast is like, hey, if you're getting ready to start a startup, make sure that you have someone in place that absolutely knows what they're doing on the insurance end, or outsource your insurance to make sure you're getting paid as quickly as possible from those insurance companies.
Yeah, that delay in like, whether it's an acquisition or a startup, whenever you switch insurance, like payer status and stuff, 90 days of getting a network or getting those checks to be sent to you just could be really trying. And so that's why you absolutely have to have a good bank or financial partner that'll float you some cash to pay payroll and pay all these expenses for potentially 3 or 4 months.
Is there anything you find more challenging about having one larger practice versus the six smaller practices? Is there any like new challenges, anything just different that you're facing now?
Scheduling. is a lot more difficult just because you have a lot more people in one practice. So scheduling kind of the complexities of when is the doctor going to be here? How many assistants do we need that day? Or how many doctors? Like, oh, we'll have four doctors here today. How many assistants do we need? Some of those things are a little bit more difficult. And then just the trying to maximize rooms gets a lot more difficult because you're like, well, okay, you know, this doctor can run 2.5 rooms, this, you know, and then we got these hygiene rooms and so forth. So that's about the only thing that's a little crazier. At a smaller practice, you have like 5 operatories or 4 operatories, yep, and you're like, okay, 2 hygiene, 2 assistants, 1 doctor, 1 front desk, we're good. Although the tough thing is, okay, your front desk is sick. Oh crap, what do we do? That's the nice thing in a larger practice. I run overstaffed every day. So I had a sterile tech come to me yesterday. She's in college. And so she said, hey, my anatomy lab's on Wednesday afternoon. So can I shift my morning, my Wednesday hours to just be the morning and for this semester? I said, yeah, absolutely. I don't care. You're actually an extra. Like, we just have you floating around to help flip surgery rooms and to answer the phone. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, you do whatever you want. Like, I'm cool with that. My office manager is on maternity leave, so that's the only reason I got that question. But yeah, it's nice running when you run a kind of a larger practice, you can be habitually overstaffed and somebody's going to be gone every day, whether it's vacation or whatnot. And so your overhead is slightly higher on the HR side. But then again, your rent, your all of your other costs, like, you know, your technology, the softwares that you run, you only pay $200 a month for the software and you get to use it divided by 4 or 5 doctors worth of production. So there's times when the scheduling kind of gets easier because we just have so many extra hands. So that's a little bit nicer, but mostly the scheduling is the most complicated thing, I think, about my week sometimes.
I remember when I first opened the first startup and you get that morning text from an employee saying, hey doc, I'm sick today, or my kid's sick today, or whatever it is. And you're freaking out because you're like, oh my God, how are we going to run this practice, you know, without one of our 2 assistants, or how are we going to run without our only front desk, you know, personnel or whatever it is. And, you know, you get through those days, you scramble, you find temps, everyone comes together. But I don't really miss that. And the nice thing about the new startups is that they're both in the same building. So it's, you know, an implant office, a general office, they're combined in one space. So for instance, our front desk personnel for the general side got sick and she basically missed like the first 2 weeks we were open. She got really sick. And our office manager was just basically able to run the front. We had like 1 office manager for both sides, you know, people helped out from the implant side and the general side to kind of make it all work, but they were able to do that kind of without missing a beat. So even though they're 2 individually smaller startup practices, they kind of were able to combine forces there into that one space. So that's been helpful.
It seems in today's day and age, it seems like people are gone just a lot. And I don't know whether that's the demographic of our younger employees, yeah, or, you know, people with kids and, you know, and I get it. My kids are small too. They bring home everything from school. So yeah, it just seems to happen. And so I was talking to some dentist recently that said, like, in the last 6 months, there hasn't been a day yet where they've been fully staffed.
Wow.
And this is out in California. So it's already a tough hiring market.
Yep.
But I'm like, oh, I don't know what to tell you. So I think they were going to actually just hire an extra sterile tech to start training them to be a dental assistant. And then I just said, yeah, you know what? Eat that cost. Because you and I know we do one more crown or one more, I mean, heck, an Invisalign start that day, it pays for your salary the whole week.
Oh my God.
And so running overstaffed is kind of a necessity in today's market.
I agree with you completely. And that's always kind of been my mindset. I mean, that's, you know, from day one, why we have a full-time hygienist, you know, for our startups and multiple assistants and, you know, all that stuff. But I've even found lately at my flagship offices, as we've grown, and I thought we were at max capacity for our team, but as we've gotten busier, you know, the days that we have 2 docs there, we're doing a bunch of Invisalign, you know, we've got other stuff going on. We've got emergencies coming in. There are days where I feel like we still don't have enough assistance, you know, to handle everything. And there's days where we either get behind or we could have fit in that extra molar endo crown if we had just had one more person to help out. So I'm thinking that I need to even bring on another person, even beyond where I thought we were at max capacity. And the thing is, if you run everything else pretty well, you can still keep payroll costs, you know, at a reasonable clip, even if you are technically overstaffed. So that's what we're trying to, you know, focus mm-hmm. on, is making sure that, you know, we're keeping other overhead costs low and we're keeping revenue high enough that even if I add one more person, it's not going to dramatically impact our payroll overhead costs. So.
Yeah. And I think I'm as bad as any to say, well, we should look at the numbers to see where your staff costs are and where the overhead could be improved. But at a certain point, if you have a good patient experience, because you have that extra person, like somebody comes in for their appointment and you have like an assistant come get them within 2 minutes and sits with them and helps the procedure go quickly, that is worth so much more in goodwill and them telling their friends than any little salary increase that eats up 0.25% in your overhead. It's kind of so, and there's all those rules of thumb you've heard of, like, okay, this many front desk per doctor or this many assistants per doctor. And I think, you know, that's when you have to go to those subjective measures of, you know, how's the patient experience? Are we answering the phones correctly? Are we checking out patients? Like, are they having to wait too long? And some of these other things that are not found on your P&L spreadsheet.
Yep. No, I think that makes perfect sense, man. So
we usually like to wrap it up around 45 minutes. Doc, I had a kind of an odd question. I know a lot of the DSI guys I've met train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Do you train?
No, I don't. No. I'm a skinny biker. I'd get my neck broken in Jiu-Jitsu.
I was really pumped. I met Mark, and he did. And then I met a few other guys throughout the last year that did. And then you guys did the belt ranks. I thought all that was really cool. So, you know, I want to wrap it up here. Thanks for coming on, Addison. It was really awesome to talk to you. Listen to you're probably unique in the marketplace that you have owned 6 practices and you've, you know, left, and then you've done a decent size to something on the way to a mega practice. I think a mega practice is anything when you start getting near 12 to 15 ops. 5 ops, 6 ops is pretty much norm. What you're really going towards is a bigger animal. And to hear the contrast of those two ownership styles is really awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. Also, everyone listening, if you don't mind clicking follow or subscribe, that'd be really important. We're trying to get our followers up. And that'd be really awesome. Dr. Vallow, do you have anything before we sign off?
Also, anyone listening, you know, on our podcast here, you should check out Addison's podcast as well. Addison, what can you tell them about your podcast real quick?
Yeah, so mine's kind of a different animal per se. It's a short daily podcast, just 2 to 5 minutes of just something to think about every day, whether that's something just for your own mental wellness or something you can mention in huddle or something during your clinical day that you can think about to just improve your life and your dentistry. And that's called the Daily Dental Podcast. And you could find that on addisonkilleen.com.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on, Addison. It was great chatting with you as always.
Hey, thank you everyone for joining. Have a great day. Check us out at Dental Unfiltered. And you can find us on both Apple and Spotify. Thank you guys.